This is The LaRouche Show. Welcome, everyone. It's Saturday, November 26, 2011, and I'm Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic for today is the most urgent question, the ouster of Obama. Now, to discuss this, we have two guests who will be talking about this in sequence. And our first guest here with me in the studio is Mike Billington. Welcome, Mike.
Glad to be here.
And who is the Asian, who is heads up our Asian desk for EIR Online, and for many decades has done so, traveled in Asia and so forth. But he especially is going to be speaking about this nine-day trip of President Obama to Asia. It was kind of an imperial gunboat tour, which we'll get into in a minute. And the second guest who will close out our show is Jeffrey Steinberg, our director of counterintelligence, who will be giving us the latest update on the general strategic situation regarding this necessity of getting Obama out of the presidency yesterday. Now, by way of introduction to Mike, let me just say this, that we recognize in the last 8 days or so that conditions came about which so far have acted to retard the setting off of warfare in Southwest Asia, in Syria or Iran, which would directly lead to World War III. But the threat continues. The menace is perhaps more live than ever. Now, Jeff Steinberg will be discussing more of the particulars about this, but you had an activation in the face of this intense danger of certain military networks in the United States and internationally, activation of diplomatic networks of other nations, activation of nuclear power and other strategic figures and agencies. For example, Mr. Hans Blix, who gave an interview to EIR on the danger and what's involved here, in the sense of any attack on Iran would lead to World War III. That interview is in the latest EIR Online. But as I say, we're going to get to that. But what we're doing now, or what I want to stress at the beginning of what Mike's going to report about this dangerous fiasco of Obama's trip in Asia, is that really it's up to each one of us to individually do everything possible to draw attention, to understand, and to move to thwart this war danger threat and the continuing breakdown of the economic conditions of life in the United States and on our planet by moving to make clear to people that Obama should just be removed from office. And there are ways to do this. We've been discussing it on this LaRouche show. And on LaRouchePAC.com, the LaRouche Political Action Committee, you're getting hour-by-hour updates on this necessary task. Let me just say this, that people should look for a particular writing by Mr. LaRouche in the last week. It was November 21. It was last Monday. And he just called it Status of the Obama Crisis. That's the name of the memo, in which he summarized the kind of thing I just referred to. We have an activation going on. There are elements within the U.S., the government, that are moving because the White House disposition to do anything that London wants in the way of creating another little, it won't be little and it won't be splendid, war in Southwest Asia is so obvious. So see that, Status of the Obama Crisis by Mr. LaRouche. It's dated November 21st. You can see it on the website. But now, as I say, to add to our perspective of what we're up against here and the nature of Obama's role for the British imperial games that are ready to set forth an unprecedented conflagration in the world unless stopped. Mike, I referred to Obama's trip in mid-November as a kind of imperial gunboat tour, and so did you, right? He was like a potentate, at least in his own head. Would you just begin by the overview on the trip?
Right. No, I think you're absolutely right. Let me actually begin by saying that the impact of this tour was such that the activation of the broader institution of the presidency, military, intelligence, and others, that you just described, which was set in motion to stop Obama and Britain's other puppet, Bibi Netanyahu, from launching this horrendous war on Iran and the almost certain escalation into global warfare, that the trip itself helped solidify in the minds of these broader layers of the institution of the presidency that LaRouche was right, that this president is stark raving mad. We have from many sources, multiple sources, both in Asia and the United States, of people who were either in on the meetings in Asia or were briefed by those who had attended these meetings, that as shocked as they were by Obama's overt push for a military and economic confrontation and open threats of military operations against China, that even more shocking to them was the state of mind of this lunatic. The fact that he was described in various ways as a man who believed that you could make global policy through rhetoric alone, a pompous attitude of an emperor with no clothes. These are some of the phrases that were picked up. And in general, not only being stunned by this, but these are generally people who have followed LaRouche's long, long-standing warning since April of 2009. That Obama was a clinically insane, narcissistic, deranged fellow who had absolutely no business being in the position of the presidency. So this tour added to that in, I think, a significant way and got these people to take action as they were being contemplating anyway because of the overt threats of the Middle East war. So basically, Obama has, through this tour, undermined and sabotaged a relatively sane policy towards Asia during his administration by the fact that he had, by and large, been tied up with his Middle East wars, with the continuation of the Bush-Cheney policy on bailing out the British financial system, both here and in Europe, and waging colonial wars in the Middle East. So he had allowed Asia policy to largely be dominated by his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and her Asia expert, Kurt Campbell, which had led to good relations, some touchiness with China, but by and large a push for collaboration on both economic and strategic issues, the most important probably being the North Korea question, where Hillary and the Chinese and the Russians have worked together with South Korea to bring about what could be, finally, the ending of the Korean War and a solution through development of the last remaining Cold War hotspot in the world, really, but in Asia, which is North Korea. But what Obama did was totally change the subject. The second subject that the Asians were interested in discussing in these three summits, of course, being the impact on Asia of the total breakdown of the financial system in Europe and the United States.
Let me interrupt you here just 1 minute. Keep that train of thought just for our listeners to know, because people may have followed this. It was 9 days. It was a very long time and everything else. Can you just give the who, what, where, when? It began in Hawaii, then went to Australia.
The three summits that were the first one was the APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, longstanding summit of Pacific nations, both on the Asia side and the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and some of the South American countries. U.S. was host of it this year, so it was in Hawaii, and it began there. He then went on to his trip to Australia, which we'll definitely discuss, where he announced a dramatic expansion of the military ring around China. And then on to Bali, Indonesia, where there were two almost simultaneous summits, one of them being the annual ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, summit, which is always in addition to the so-called ASEAN plus three, China, Japan, and South Korea, and now the ASEAN plus one with India. And the U.S. was and generally has been invited to attend. And then a relatively newer summit called the East Asia Summit, which was originally launched by Dr. Mahathir in Malaysia, as a grouping that excluded the Western powers, that it was an Asia-only concept of being able to get together amongst themselves alone. That concept was picked away piece by piece, and then finally this year, for the first time, the United States and Russia were invited to attend. But the concern of the Asian interests for this was the fact that we're in the midst of the biggest global economic breakdown crisis in history. And despite the fact that Asia in general is still on a positive trajectory for some economic development, they are very much aware that no one's going to survive if the entire European and American market completely collapses in this financial bubble bursting, as it is now, in fact, bursting, as you can see in Europe and in the United States. So that was their primary concern. Obama usurped the agenda to turn it into economic warfare against China, blaming China as the primary culprit in the collapse in the West because supposedly they manipulate their currency and so on. Crazy stuff. But then also a strategic confrontation where they took the issue of confrontations in the South China Sea over certain territorial claims between China and the Philippines and Malaysia and Brunei and Indonesia and others, Taiwan, and turned that into a strategic threat to the United States. And I'd like to explain that, too. Do you want to do that first?
First, let's summarize. So you were but to recap, as you were saying before, Obama changed the subject. The subjects that were uppermost in the minds of leaders in Asia include that it's so obvious the world financial and economic breakdown has huge is taking a terrible toll, and
which was virtually undiscussed in all three summits.
There was practically not
a word about what to do about the fact that the West is self-destructing and that it's threatening to bring the entire world down.
And again, to go from Hawaii to Australia and then to Indonesia, because I know you followed the presentations that Obama made, the world did, and literally the rhetoric he used beginning in Hawaii, you've covered some of this. I want to point out to people that Mike Billington's article in EIR Online, the latest one, Mike, I forget the exact, it covers the fact, I don't have the exact title.
It was Obama's trip to Asia had only one purpose, war on China.
So it specifically you're specifically covering this singling out of China. But you said in Hawaii, you even said accused China of breaking the rules. And
Yeah. The whole theme was both militarily and economically, Obama claims that China is virtually an outlaw state. He kept saying, they've got to play by the rules. They've got to play by the rules, meaning they have to revalue their currency more rapidly than they are. They have to agree to dropping any kind of prohibitions, and they don't. They should stop supporting their industries. That's supposedly unfair to global free trade. This kind of imperial dogmatism, being thrown out by Obama. And again, as I said, in a very, very pompous way. He said at one point in Hawaii that the Chinese are just going to have to grow up and learn to play by the rules. You can imagine the impact this had, not only in the people participating, but in the Chinese population, which we have had very clear reading that the rage against this fanatic within the Chinese population was huge. And in fact, the Chinese government, which is equally concerned, one of their concerns is that it's liable to stir up such rage in the population that some efforts to solve this and restore good relations is going to be rather difficult. That's how intense the Obama barrage was throughout this tour. Largely in Hawaii, he focused on the economic issues, the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit, and then took the time from there to go to Australia.
Then we'll get to the, in other words, empirically, because it's going to be, when you go through it, I'm sure it's so dramatic, the military force side of the U.S. and also before we get into what you'd already referred to, this kind of concocted issue of the open navigation of the seas.
Right, right.
But first, what in Australia?
Well, he went to Australia, and this was pre-announced, so it wasn't a complete surprise. But he and the Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard, a total British puppet herself, announced that the U.S. was establishing a huge airbase in Darwin on the northern shore of Australia, just 500 miles south of the Indonesian islands, and with a straight shot into the waters around China and the South China Sea and the Pacific, and into the Indian Ocean, for that matter, as well. Establishing a base, most of the news has focused on the 2,500 Marines who will be based permanently in this situation. But far more important, actually, is that this is going to be a huge airbase for B-52 bombers, as well as F-18 fighter planes, drones, which will be deployed in the region, docking facilities for nuclear submarines. We're talking big, big infrastructure, pre-positioning of military supplies, and submarines and other kinds of operations. This is a huge operation. They went through the sort of joke of calling it not a base because it's going to be located within an Australian base. But it is going to be one of the larger bases that the U.S. deploys around the world. And military professionals and others, strategists, have made a very, very clear point that this base not only continues the ring around China, but that it is out of range of the Chinese ballistic missiles, which the other U.S. bases in the Pacific, in Japan and Korea and Guam, are not. They are in range. So this is providing a base somewhat out of the range of Chinese operations. I think to understand this, you have to get a sense of the U.S. strategic doctrine, which has been adopted, called Air-Sea Battle, designed by Andy Marshall, the old coot at the Pentagon, who's been an anti-China fanatic for most of his many, many years. But this has been adopted as U.S. strategic policy. The idea here, and Obama explained this in different terms, but the idea of the air-sea battle is to get away from the counterinsurgency. We've basically, solved, supposedly, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which, of course, is false, and, in fact, we're ready to go to war on Iran and Syria. But we've supposedly—
And Africa, too.
And Africa, as well.
Yeah, right.
But we've sort of ended that phase, and we're ready to move back into an advanced air and naval capacity against a major power, rather than counterinsurgency operations against these backward powers. And, of course, the key to this is the threat from China, supposedly, is that they are expanding their military and they're capable of excluding the United States from what they consider to be their strategic area. And this is a military threat in the view of these British imperial thinkers, that China's advance, their development, the fact that they're modernizing their military gives them supposedly a capacity to prevent U.S. military operations in the region, perhaps over a conflict with Taiwan or these conflicts over the South China Sea. And therefore, we have to prepare for war. Now, Obama didn't exactly use those terms, but using the conflict in the South China Sea, which, according to the Obama administration, is a conflict over the freedom of navigation. Now, this is a hoax because there is no freedom of navigation problem in the South China Sea. There have been some confrontations between Chinese and Philippine military and fishing boats, between Vietnam and China and others. But they were not over freedom of navigation. They were over whether or not somebody was fishing in somebody else's territory or looking for oil in somebody else's territory. These kinds of issues having to do with territorial control over issues. And the Chinese and the ASEAN countries have tried to move to solve this thing peacefully. But there were some conflicts in 2010, which stirred up some concern. But what Obama and the military argues here is that the freedom of navigation is being challenged, which is just sort of a non-military way of saying an exclusion of our access forces. So you have to see this as part of this shift to an air-sea battle approach to containing and confronting and actually carrying out military operations against China. And the political side of this is that Obama was basically playing a you better join us or else, very similar to the Bush-Cheney, either you're with us or you're against us, a coalition of the willing. Either you join us on a free trade pact called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is designed to exclude China and to be an economic agreement under U.S. domination, and you basically ally with us in this confrontation with China over the South China Sea and military issues, or you are against us, and you're going to be facing the threat of the kind of operations that we now see commonplace by Emperor Obama, which is that if we don't like a country, we take it out.
So, and the words you're using, some of them I understand in the last week were one of the leaders of parliament. I'm sorry, I can't recall now if it was Malaysia or Indonesia, actually used the terminology of saying this emperor has no clothes.
That was not the you're thinking of the foreign minister in Indonesia. He didn't use that term. That was a term used by a media reporter here. Commenting on comments that he'd heard from the Asians. But yes, the foreign minister of Indonesia was very concerned. And in fact, there's indications that the U.S. and Australia in this case broke a treaty with Indonesia called the Lombok Treaty, signed in 2006, which said that neither country would create new strategic agreements without consulting each other. And one person, one commenter writing on this said, well, Australia might say they're consulting us by announcing that it's going to go into place next year. But what would they think if we invited the Chinese to set up a military base in Bali and then said, oh, by the way, they're there?
That's
so
right.
This is taken very seriously. Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, the president in Indonesia himself, made very clear that this is a challenge and an unwelcome challenge by the ASEAN countries. He was meeting with Gillard, the Prime Minister of Australia, who was trying to assure him that this was no threat to Indonesia. And he said, and she said to him, just to show that this is no threat to Indonesia, we invite you to send your troops down and do joint exercises with us, the U.S. and Australia. And President Yudhoyono very cleverly said, yeah, that's a great idea. I'll invite the Chinese to come with us, which the Australian foreign minister that had to say after choking, well, that's an interesting idea. It won't happen right away, but, you know, we can think about that. So it's very clear that the Asian leaders know that this is a danger to their region. And in fact, the foreign minister said we were peaceful. Until this moment, we had a relative agreements amongst the Asian nations, and this move by the United States has thrown that into disarray and is a danger of military confrontation, which could become global.
Right, and there are even more particulars. I understand Philippines. There's been a motion that more United States forces will now be emplaced there.
We've had troops in the Philippines for I forget exactly how many, 6 or 8 years already, somewhat illegally in the sense that the Philippine Constitution forbids foreign bases on their soil. So they got around that, as they are in Australia, by saying it's not really a base. They don't call it a base, but but it's a permanent presence. And we're largely aiding in counterinsurgency against some of the Islamic insurgencies in southern Philippines. But Obama deployed Hillary to the Philippines. She spoke on a military aircraft or ship, and announced that, or rather her national security spokesman announced, that the entire deployment in the Philippines is going to be shifted to maritime, clearly aimed at trying to get a military confrontation with China over the South China Sea issues, the Spratly Islands in particular, which are claimed by both. So Obama mentioned this in his speech in Australia. He mentioned that they're going to have expanding basing rights in Vietnam as well as in Singapore. So this cannot be mistaken. I mean, there's no attempt to hide the fact that this is a huge strategic shift. In fact, by the way, I think in the New York Times this morning, William Paff, the very established journalist, has an article which just basically points to Obama's lunacy. He says, what in the world is going on here? Who would want a war with China? And correctly concludes that is this not an attempt to divert attention globally and even internally in the United States and Europe from the economic collapse taking place to rally around a military confrontation, which, of course, in the age of the nuclear weapons, they're talking about carrying out the British goal of eliminating 6 billion out of the 7 billion people on Earth. Asia being the most populous area of the world, it's the most desirable for nuclear warfare on behalf of Prince Philip and his fellow genocidalists who believe the biggest problem in the world is that there's too many people, and we oligarchs don't have the room to carry out our, you know, whatever they do, not to be mentioned on a family program.
Yeah. Well, back to, again, these different whistle stops on this trip. It's a little, if it weren't so epic and potentially tragic, it's like a Gilbert and Sullivan opera with the Lord High Executioner and all these characters. But in Australia, the LaRouche co-thinker effort there, the Citizens Electoral Council, the CEC, I think in Darwin, where there was a speech, Obama gave a rah-rah speech, like a campaign speech, with running out in front of thousands of people to both Australian and U.S. military. They had, would you tell us about that? Because they put the Obama symbol there in front.
Right. But this was actually both Obama and Gillard were on a stage together addressing some sort of a crowd. I don't know if it was military or not. But one of our co-thinkers there in the CEC succeeded in getting a large poster, the Impeach Obama poster, with the ubiquitous and now very famous mustache, Hitler mustache on Obama, lifted up over some other sign right behind the two of them. And the leading news wire service in Australia, and this is, I think this is the most instructive of all, not only did Obama and Gillard see the poster, but the leading newswire service chose to run a split picture caption on the lead of their wires going out on Obama's trip to Darwin, which showed on the left the Impeach Obama with the Hitler mustache and just on the right Obama and Gillard looking on. So it's very clear that you have, even in the media, in Asia, even in Australia, largely a British-controlled colony still to a great extent. But our CEC people are fighting that. They're finding great support in fighting this. They had distributed tens of thousands of a newspaper on the British role in global genocide.
I think they had over almost a 500,000 email or other alerts about the situation.
Yes, the horse-faced queen had just visited one of her colonies a few weeks before, and they greeted her visit with this 500,000, was it, or 1 million leaflets. In a relatively small country, this has an enormous impact. So this is a fight. It's a continuing fight. As we said at the beginning, Obama has been stalled. The British have been stalled in their effort to launch war on Iran immediately. But by no means is it finished. This is a full-scale conflict. The only way this is going to be stopped is for the removal of Obama from office. And in a certain sense, this trip, by demonstrating to what is unquestionably the most important part of the world today, the Asia Pacific, where the focus of the one solution to this world problem, as LaRouche has emphasized, is this great Pacific alliance between Russia and China and the United States, with Korea and Japan and the Southeast Asian countries playing a crucial role. If we can get this lunatic out of the White House and get the United States back on a target of great development, great infrastructure, collaboration with our allies in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt and Kennedy, for that matter, then this region is going to be the center for the greatest development in history over this next century. If we cannot get Obama out, we're going to end up bombing it. We're going to be at war with them. Precisely the British concept. The British view is that this potential alliance between the United States and Russia and China, that must be stopped at all costs. It's the only alliance which has the power to circumvent the British imperial control over the financial system of the world and to actually create a new one along the lines of LaRouche's Glass-Steagall approach. So they are absolutely intent in preventing that. They do not want to see this Asian development proceeding the way it is in the midst of the collapse in the West, and therefore they are not only willing but intent on destroying it. And thirdly and most importantly, as I said, this is where most of the people are, and they want them dead.
Yeah, and just to pick up, to draw out a few things, instances of what you're describing, this court of characters around Obama that's in the White House that's perpetrating this kind of thing. One of them, I think, is Tom Donilon, who he's the national security advisor to Obama. And he said yesterday, in fact, let me just point out here, we're pre-recording this section of the program, and we're doing it on November 23rd because of the certain scheduling reasons, so that New York Times FAF articles November 23rd that Mike mentioned, and also on November 22nd in Washington, D.C., on Thanksgiving week in Washington, there was still this warfare effort. Tom Donilon, I was mentioning, Obama's national security advisor, was speaking at the Brookings Institution then, and he said that Tehran and Iran is overreaching itself. It's expanding like never before. And he was laying for the conditions to say that sanctions aren't going to be enough de facto. Get ready for war. Now, was he on the trip with Obama?
What I said at the beginning about how Obama had basically sabotaged what earlier had been a State Department-led Asia policy for the United States under Hillary Clinton and Kurt Campbell. Donilon was the man on the spot throughout the tour.
Okay.
Anybody who heard Donilon yesterday at Brookings on the Iran thing, I tuned in not knowing who was speaking, and I thought, sure, I was listening to one of Bibi Netanyahu's most rabid fanatics in his railing about why we have to destroy Iran. And in fact, this is not different from the tone of the message being carried by Donilon and Obama on the entire Asian tour. It's of note that Donilon is not, he's the national security advisor to Obama. He is not a national security person. He has no experience. He, just like Obama, has no right to be in the position he's in terms of any qualifications, let alone quality of mind. Donilon himself is a political hack who was brought in as a hack to serve as national security advisor as one of Obama's controllers, and a very dangerous position indeed.
Right, I guess that is what qualifies him to to work for the imperial crowd you were just characterizing before by saying it's a matter of record and a matter of decades of documentation that characters like Prince Philip and all the rest, Prince Charles, the Queen herself, Tony Blair, all the variety pack, say the world is overpopulated. If we've just been celebrating having 7 billion people in the world, but they see it the oppositely. And of course, 3 to 4 billion live in Asia, which now you're saying the Obama announced we're going to reorient because we have to prepare for war in this part of the world. I mean, that's how stark it is.
And I can mention here that the Chinese public posture in response to this has been somewhat mooted. There have been numerous articles placed in their official newspapers, both the party paper and the government paper, which say this is crazy, it's dangerous, there's a threat of war, and so forth. But we know from sources there that while the public response has been somewhat mooted, the internal discussion and, like I said earlier, the response in the population is rageful and very, very angry. In that light, the Russians are being much less diplomatic. In fact, Lavrov this morning issued a statement saying it's clear that this is a push for war. Could it be that they're doing this because they need some diversion from the economic breakdown crisis facing Europe and the United States? So it was the most overt statement yet from the Russian side. This is the foreign minister of
Russia.
That'd
be November 23rd.
This is the 23rd, yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll have more on that for the briefing tomorrow. But this is a situation where increasingly no one in the world is unaware that America is at this point not only a total British puppet, but is carrying out a launching of a global, unquestionably nuclear war policy that could be unleashed at virtually any moment. As General Hoar, the former head of CENTCOM, said in an interview with EIR, I am terrified that I'm going to wake up one morning and find that it's a fait accompli. It's been launched, that the Israelis have hit Iran. Iran is responding by hitting various U.S. Forces. The Obama then comes in and says, oh, we have to defend ourselves against this, and so on. And within hours, we could be in a global confrontation with Russia and China, and nuclear bombs could be flying. This is the level of lunacy demonstrated by the Asia tour and by just about everything else that's being done by this White House, and which demands that people act with a sense that they themselves find in themselves something bigger than themselves, bigger than life itself, something inside which defines them as human beings who at a moment of a threat, not only to them and their family and their country, but to civilization, that they find the powers within themselves to act in unison with others of goodwill to make sure that this is carried out immediately, the removal of this danger in the form of Obama, and then moving on to implementing the policies that can actually stop this global breakdown.
Right, and I think that you mentioned this strategically very important public response now coming out of Moscow. Also, there have been some other things, right? Is it the case in Malaysia, Dr. Mahathir, a leading figure there, has had a recent panel? Is that true?
Well, I don't want to give too much. Dr. Mahathir, several years ago, who I think people generally know, he was one of the more courageous leaders in the world, actually, in fighting against the IMF World Bank dictatorship in the 2000s, in 97, 98, when the so-called Asian financial crisis. And when he then left the prime ministership in Malaysia, but he very angry that the UN and the ICC and the other bodies supposedly concerned with war crimes and human rights violations did absolutely nothing about the totally public exposed fact that Tony Blair and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney had launched illegal wars in especially the Iraq case based on intentional lies and so on and so forth. So he set up a panel himself with international lawyers, including Francis Boyle, who has just done two weeks ago. Oh,
here.
He was on this show. Good. That's
yes,
right.
Yes, and
did
EIR
an interview, mm-hmm. And who has drawn up impeachment papers on Obama. But he was one of the lawyers brought in to hear the evidence, and they found them guilty. There's no question about that. I'm just disappointed that it appears they did not try to say the obvious, which is that what Obama is doing today is worse than what Bush and Cheney did. So it appears, anyway, from my first looking at this, that the Obama issue was not raised, and they are condemning something that everybody already knows is the extreme war guilt of the Bush-Cheney-Tony Blair team.
Well, maybe that's all the more. It stresses your prior point that it's up to all of us to not hold back or pull
exactly.
any punches.
It's not there's nothing to criticize in what they did, but at a moment of potential World War III, any minute is not a time to be going back and feeling good about condemning what happened, 10 years ago.
Right. Well, because of your time, I guess this draws it to conclusion. You can add more, but I'll reiterate again, we're very glad to have had Mike Billington, Asia Desk, EIR Online, And we were pre-recording this segment, November 23. And do you want to say anything else, Mike?
No,
or
that's
our
fine.
Work is cut out
Thanks
for us.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we know what to do.
Okay, thank you, Mike Billington. Now we turn to Jeff Steinberg. Jeff, let me ask you this. Why don't you begin with characterizing some of the expressions of institutional opposition by agencies, by leading figures in the United States and abroad to this unhinged kind of London and Obama war drive insanity that we've seen in the last 2 weeks?
Okay, well, look, I think the point is that it's unprecedented in both the United States and in Israel. The military and national security institutions of both countries have weighed in loud and clear that there is no basis at the present time for military action against Iran. And in both cases, you've had leading officials say that any kind of an attack on Iran, whether by Israel or by the United States, would have catastrophic consequences that nobody should take lightly. For one thing, we have a complete financial and economic collapse of the transatlantic region in particular, and any kind of disruption of the Persian Gulf region that an attack on Iran would most certainly cause would shoot up oil prices overnight to at least $200 a barrel. That would blow out the world economy. So there are people who just simply say, number one, Iran is nowhere even remotely close to having a nuclear weapon. In fact, this year there was an update of the national intelligence estimate that was done by the intelligence community of the United States in November of 2007, which said that Iran at one point did have a nuclear weapons program, but they froze it in 2003, and there's no evidence they've resumed it again. So as far as the nuclear mushroom cloud rhetoric that we saw from the likes of Condi Rice and Dick Cheney going into the Iraq war, and lo and behold, there was no WMD. Here you've got an even more cut-and-dried situation because the IAEA has inspectors on the ground. They have monitors. They have cameras at all of the Iranian nuclear facilities, and they say, well, they've enriched some uranium, which is allowed under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it's all accounted for, every gram of it is accounted for, and therefore there's no diversion to a weapons program. So you've had these loud voices publicly and behind the scenes. In Israel, you had the former head of the Israeli Defense Force, General Mofaz, who's now a member of the Knesset. You had Meir Dagan, the former head of the Mossad. You had many, many other officials weighing in, and what they're worried about is in Israel, you've got a lunatic named Netanyahu. In the United States, you've got a lunatic named Obama. And nobody can confidently predict what their behavior will be because both of them are on a tight British string. And there's a faction in Britain, the radical Malthusians, typified by Prince Philip, who want to blow up the world. They want to reduce the world's population by 80%. And nuclear war is one damn good way to do that. So that's the situation. In fact, Marcia, I would say that the most important news of the day in the recent period is precisely the fact that there has not been a war already. In London, the target date was the first week of November. It didn't happen because, for one thing, Lyndon LaRouche issued a clarion call to stop the war and identified London, as opposed to the White House or Netanyahu's office in Israel, as the source of this war danger, and warned that you've got this crazy genocidal faction that wants to blow things up, particularly in Eurasia and into the Pacific region, because while Europe and the United States are sinking into the ocean, you have relative economic stability in places like China, Russia, India, Japan, South Korea. And for the British imperial faction, the idea of losing the control that has been an unbroken continuity with very few exceptions since the time of the Peloponnesian Wars, and losing the oligarchical principle as the dominant principle organizing society, they'd rather bring everything down than let that happen. And it happens to also fit with their desires to create some kind of bizarre postmodern feudal world order of less than a billion people.
Right. And let me, since some of the specifics on this, just to underscore the news of the day that you pointed out, that this did not, you know, with the LaRouche's call, with others heeding that and activating behind the scenes public statements, these kinds of things also include the fact that I understand there was a meeting at the White House or a meeting with Obama by some of the military interests saying he should act on to restrain some attack out of Israel against Iran, but Obama said no, right?
Yeah, that's right. We know from sources in the Pentagon that a group of top generals went to the president and said, look, for a whole variety of reasons that they spelled out, you must make sure that under no circumstances does Israel launch a unilateral attack against Iran. Now, one of the reasons for this is that the United States has naval forces in the Persian Gulf. We've got 120,000 troops still positioned between Afghanistan and Iraq, an even larger number of contractors who are by and large retired military people. And so the Pentagon basically said to the president, we need 45 to 90 days in order to put a force protection plan in place if there's going to be any kind of conflict. And if the Israelis strike and don't even tell us in advance, then there's a very real chance that all of these U.S. military forces will be the very first targets that are gone after by the Iranians in retaliation. And the president's attitude was very cavalier and insane. You know, it was a Nero-like response. He said, well, that's too bad. They don't tell us what to do, and we will not tell them what to do. And he said, frankly, if the Israelis are going to launch a preemptive attack against Iran, I'd prefer that they don't tell us. Now, that's exactly the opposite to the message that's been delivered repeatedly to the Israelis by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Before he retired, Admiral Mullen made frequent trips to Israel with that message. General Mattis, the head of the Central Command, the head of NATO, the American Admiral Stavridis, the new Secretary of Defense, Panetta, they've all delivered that message clean and unambiguous, and Obama's on the other side. He's on a different track, and nobody can figure out where he's getting it from except for Mr. LaRouche, who says, hey, it's coming from London, plain and simple. Get real. Figure it out. This guy is not only a Nero, but he is a British agent. They put him in, and they installed him precisely for a moment like this.
Right. And in that sense, Jeff, you might, as we've pointed to during this program and referred people to read the November 21st strategic evaluation put out by Mr. LaRouche, the status of the Obama crisis, that one of the things that's been more glaring and more blatant, the kind of thing you described, or what Mike Billington described about Obama's warmongering trip to the Asia-Pacific region, that the potential, if everyone acts, to do what otherwise might have seemed impossible, that is, force the issue and have him put aside, is greater by the hour at the same time the danger is, right?
That's exactly right. Look, there's an increasing recognition that this guy is a mental case. We had the incident just last Sunday where Chris Matthews, who was one of the real Obama groupies during the 2008 campaign.
I think he was a groupie leader. I think you're right.
And who defended Obama up and down the line during the first couple of years of his presidency. he was being interviewed Sunday on MSNBC, and he had basically a meltdown. It was not pre-programmed. It was a spontaneous outburst. And he said, what the hell is it with this guy? Why is he even in as president? He said it's a virtual presidency disconnected from reality. And he was absolutely right. And there's many, many more people who are coming around to the view that Mr. LaRouche expressed in even more graphic detail as early as April of 2009, when he said, Obama has the personality of Emperor Nero.
Well, in the remaining minutes, let's go again to what you touched on, but that is the puppet master, those in control, the lines of control out of London, that it's fine with them, with these special financial imperial political interests. We're not talking about the English people or the United Kingdom governments. But genocide is fine. In other words, mass homicide, mass death is fine. And if you want to, I know for decades, Jeff, you have been making this point in multiple ways, that that's what we're up against right now.
Yeah, look, this is, Mr. LaRouche has put this in very, very clear terms. What we're dealing with is a fight between two systems. It's an old fight. It goes back to, again, the time of the Peloponnesian Wars, where you had, in the writings of Plato and Socrates and others, a clear elucidation of a republican concept. And then on the other side, you had the various expressions of the oligarchical principle, which basically says that the overwhelming majority of human beings are to be treated like cattle or like slaves. And they are to be at the beck and call of some, you know, God-given elite, which in Greek mythology were referred to as the gods with small g. And so this has been a persistent fight. The Renaissance coming out of the Dark Age was a reflection of this republican impulse. The colonization of North America was conceptualized by Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa in his last will, and it was the document that sort of forged the original Columbus exploration. The English-speaking colonists in North America brought ideas to this shore that could never be implemented in Europe because of the power of the oligarchical principle, and that was the basis of the American Revolution. So this fight is a persistent theme without history, because it remains unresolved. And we're really at a kind of a showdown moment where we're basically the last 2,500 years of history, which is largely the history of the development of Western civilization, is coming to a showdown moment where it's no longer possible, for a whole variety of reasons, including the advent of thermonuclear weapons, that the oligarchical system and a republican nation-state system can no longer coexist on this planet. One or the other is going to win, and either we win, in which case we can enjoy a renaissance of unprecedented proportion, or we lose and humanity goes down the tube, because you can't put a stopwatch on the disintegration of civilization. You can't say, all right, 6 billion people die and 1 billion people live. That's just simply utopian lunacy. Either we go into a dark age in which all of mankind is jeopardized, probably by nuclear war, or we defeat the oligarchy, defeat its current expression in the British Empire, and we go on to rebuild this planet in the right way.
Right. Now, I think that many of the people listening to this are... I think there's no confusion about what side they're on.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
When you try and figure out what you're going to do and so forth, let me just in the closing minutes here point out that just in the last few days and weeks, the EIR has been publishing, and the LaRouche Political Action Committee on its website every hour of every other day has been put out new ammunition to use, to circulate, to distribute, to hit people over the heads with. For example, Congress is coming back. As they've been misbehaving is a polite way to put it. But after the Thanksgiving holiday, the turkeys are coming back to Washington.
That's for sure.
And they can be given orders. And you personally and others, for example, you interviewed Mr. Hans Blix. He's the Swedish scientist who was the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency for, I think, about 16 years and had other positions. And he, in particular, warned that there's no grounds for this bogus claim that Iran should be attacked because they're building nuclear weapons. So, but would you say something about the ammunition and what you advise people to how to go about thinking what they can do?
We've got to get rid of President Obama. There has to be a groundswell from the American people, and it will resonate within the governing institutions of the country. I can tell you that all the way up to the level of members of the president's own cabinet, there is discussion about the fact that he's not mentally fit to serve. And the pressure is enormous for there to be an invoking of the 25th Amendment or for there to be the convening of an impeachment proceeding against him for any one of a number of crimes that have been committed. But you're not going to get the courage out of those people in Washington, even facing imminent catastrophic destruction in a thermonuclear war, unless there's something resonating in the population that says, this guy has got to go. We have basically one serious flank available to us to stop this war from erupting, if not now, at some future point. And the only way that we're going to be able to successfully do that is by getting an outpouring from the American people demanding his removal from office. So that's the message. There's many things that you can do in terms of exactly how to go about that. But there is no replacement for the fact that that is what must happen.
Yes, I'll just point out that, and Jeff, you may add to this, some people, retired military, other people who've held office, have themselves been issuing statements. I think you, is that, one of them's been carrying some of the major media in the last 2 weeks, right?
Yes.
And so the, it's not as if there's some, let's just put it this way, this by no means is whistling in the dark.
No, this is very real, and it's look, it became a matter of immediate urgency at the point that we had this war danger really thrust upon us. And, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, when Netanyahu began mouthing off about an Israeli preemptive strike against Iran because Israel was on the verge of obtaining nuclear weapons, all of this stuff, suddenly it woke a lot of people up that what Mr. LaRouche first said in April of 2009 about Obama as Emperor Nero was suddenly playing out right in front of our eyes. And so, yeah, people are waking up. People are scared, but it's going to take a groundswell from the American people to convince them that this is the moment when there is no alternative.
Yes, and you know, some of the it's always good to step outside, deliberately put your mind to stepping outside the media environment that's created. But as Mike Billington described earlier on this discussion, you had for 9 days the Obama going around the Pacific telling China they should grow up and play by the rules, issuing other kinds of little dictator statements right and left. And then you have other members of the cabinet. This Mike Billington went into Tom Donilon,
right,
the National Security Advisor. You hear this. But in fact, so it's naturally then, if the discussion is going to be who's threatening war here, I think President Medvedev of Russia on November 23rd warned that let's get serious about missile pacts between the United States and Russia. We're not just going to take any more rhetoric.
Yep.
So that underscores just what you said, Jeff. This is the showdown time.
Exactly right.
Okay, well, I think that, as I told people before, this we are pre-taping due to schedule issues, but this is the November 26th, 2011 LaRouche Show. I thank you very much for being on, Jeff Steinberg, and we take to heart everything you say. And Mike Billington, likewise, thanks for being on. This will close the show today. This is Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you.